It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a trip back in time to talk about the history of the supermarket and how now, even in times of change, we have an abundance of choices when shopping. First, pandemic is the word of the year. That's according to Merriam-Webster. It became official today. The dictionary website saw a massive increase in searches when scientists and world leaders started using pandemic so widely. Now it's just kind of part of how we talk. The word pandemic is simply one of the examples of how this contagious coronavirus has changed a lot about life as we know it. That includes the English language. We're talking about it now, and you're part of this conversation. Call 800-642-1234. What words or terms have you found yourself using in these past months that are maybe new to English, or you're hearing used a lot more or in different ways? Do you like watching how language evolves over time, or do you wish it was harder for new trendy words to make it into everyday use? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR to join this conversation. We've got Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett on the line. They are co-hosts and co-producers of the public radio program Away with Words, which, by the way, you can hear on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. Grant, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hi, Keely.
Hi, and Martha, always great to have you with us.
Hey, Keely, thanks. It's great to be back.
Martha, let's start with pandemic. It used to be this technical term. We didn't want to use it. Now my elementary-aged kids talk about the pandemic, and they know generally what it means. How about this word becoming really conversational now?
Well, it certainly has, hasn't it? It goes all the way back to ancient Greek, pan meaning all, and demic coming from the Greek word demos, which means people. It's the same root for democracy. And so a pandemic is a disease that has extended throughout the population. And we've certainly seen that now, and we're certainly hearing it more and more.
And Grant, what about this idea that sometimes words, they exist for a long time, but we don't use them as much, and then suddenly we bring them into conversation?
That's true. It's when we all kind of rally together or have a common cause that we create this instant vocabulary, these shorthand words and expressions and initialisms, abbreviations for the things that we need to talk about quickly so that we don't have to elaborate and use the longer form. And that's what happened here. We're all together in this. We're all helping the people who are having difficult times. We're all helping the people who've lost loved ones or lost their jobs or are not coping very well under lockdown. And we need this new language, whether it be medical language or just the new language of living our different lives, in order to express solidarity, to have quick communication. You'll see this also in wartime. You'll see this in sports when people work together on a team. You'll see this in offices when people are on a big project together over a long period of time. They develop kind of an instant language that they, at the end of it, they could almost write a glossary or a little dictionary.
How do new words come into a language in general? I mean, is it always around some shared experience?
Well, sure. You certainly see that with slang. Slang is the language of an in-group. And if you're using slang and other people understand you, then you know that they're part of your group. And we always like to talk the way the way that the people we admire talk as well. If you're hearing a celebrity or a learned person you admire use a certain kind of language, you're going to start to use that language yourself. And that's happened with a lot of the language that's grown up around the pandemic. You know, there's a lot of slang just for the name of the disease itself. And, you know, one gets a little uncomfortable talking about slang terms for that disease because it is the cause of so much tragedy and grim experience for people. But certainly as language people, we like to watch the evolution of language itself and sort of study it clinically. So there are long, long, long lists of words that we have just referring to the virus itself, the disease itself.
Yeah, Antonio Lillo of the University of Alicante, Spain, put out a paper where he collected 270 different terms for the virus itself. And many of them can't be repeated on the air because they're racist or derogatory, but they're things like Miley Cyrus, which is rhyming slang, or bat flu, or pangolin fever, La Rona, Doña Rona, Macarona, Sharona, things like that.
We are talking with Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, co-hosts and producers of the public radio program Away with Words. And we're taking your calls, your emails at ideas@WPR.org. How have you seen language changing during the pandemic related to this new coronavirus and in other ways? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We've got Jill from Madison now who has noticed something. Hey, Jill.
Hi.
What have you realized as people are talking about things during this pandemic?
I just had a fun term that I came across last week with the holiday going on that I had heard people celebrating Plaguesgiving rather than Thanksgiving, considering there were many people that didn't obey kind of the suggestions from the CDC and the different health organizations. And I thought that was a creative way to slightly shame the situation, but also kind of just make a fun term to make light of something that could be very frustrating.
Yeah, Jill, thanks for mentioning that. Grant, have you heard of Plaguesgiving at this point?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I heard a bunch of Thanksgiving-related ones. Yeah, because there were people who, they're just tired of the restrictions, and they decided to take the chance. And I feel for them. They're missing their loved ones. They're missing that family experience. Sometimes this is the only time of the year that they're all together, and they didn't want to miss it. So they decided to take the chance. And Plaguesgiving is a kind of the dark humor that we've all been adopting over the, you know, since February or even earlier to talk about this kind of grim, as Martha put it, sensibility. You know, maybe even they use that term themselves to talk about the gathering with the family. So I've heard a bunch of different terms like this. Shamesgiving was another one, which I'm going anyway. You can call it Thanksgiving. You can call it Shamesgiving, but I'm going anyway.
Yeah, and it brings up terms that we use now without even thinking about it, like your COVID bubble, you know, that group of family members that you've gone into isolation with and you feel safe with. You might talk about opening the bubble to let somebody in when you welcome a new person who's perhaps tested negative.
Or sometimes people call them the quarantine, T-E-A-M. Mm-hmm. Your quarantine is the people who you trust because you know they've been following the same restrictions you have. You know that if they come over that they haven't been lying to you about being with a bunch of unmasked people and that they're not going to give you the virus.
I have to say, the first time I heard quarantine, I think it was early in the summer, and I rolled my eyes. Like, I physically remember rolling my eyes at the wordplay. And now it's just, like, something that I accept as a real thing that people deal with. But that's one of the challenges we have with language changing, right, is that, mm-hmm. you know, it starts out as something that people don't take seriously or that is, you know, just kind of different because, you know, it's not something we use. And then suddenly people are saying it and incorporating it. And some of us have to say, wait, what did you just say? And what does that mean? And how do I use it?
Yeah. Some of the COVID words are a little stunty. You know, they're just stunts. Like, I think that zumping, referring to being dumped by your romantic partner on Zoom, is one of those terms that's much more talked about than it is actually used. But you're right. When we first run into slang, we eye roll, we scorn it. But if it lasts, we can't believe that we're soon saying it. I remember people's response to bling bling, and how long did that last? Of course, now it's passé and nobody uses it. I mean, it's long past its sell-by date, but for a while there, it was the hot thing.
Well, and I think Grant brings up a good term when he says using, because if this term is useful, it's going to be more of a flash in the pan.
Sure.
It isn't going to be more of a flash pan. You mean if they're not using it, it's just going to burn out super fast, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for me, I have started using Blur's Day for, you know, that day when you don't even know what day it is.
Right. Because Martha, you and I are the same. We work with home studios and home setups, and mm-hmm. every day is the same. We do a little work on Saturday and Sundays and on the holidays, and they're all the same. You know, we talk to listeners pretty much every day, one way or the other. It's just every day is a blur day.
Sure. So Blur's Day, any day that, you know, because of lockdown's disorienting effect on time, mm-hmm. who cares what day it is? It all feels the same.
But, you know, Keely, right. like a lot of these terms, like pandemic, that term is 20 years old. It's got a life before the pandemic, but it got new vigor, new energy from the pandemic.
Yeah. And another example of that is social distancing. I mean, I can remember hearing that term early on, maybe February or something like that, mm-hmm. and just thinking, well, that's sort of an odd term. And I don't think twice about using it. I mean, I guess I think about, is it socially distant? My gathering was socially distant, or was I social distance? You know, it's taking lots of different forms, but it's a term that's kind of pliable and adaptable. And I think that one's here to stay.
Well, it dates back to the 1950s.
Right.
In general use, and specifically in relationship to infectious disease, to the early 2000s. And I was reading the other day about how difficult it is to translate that concept, and even those two words of social distancing, into other languages, and how hard it is, how much of an Anglophone idea the social distancing is, not just the words, but the concept, because it doesn't apply to some other cultures in the way that they live and they form their family units and they form their work cultures and so forth. So it's just really interesting, too, to think beyond the Anglosphere of how you express these concepts of staying away from people. You know, what if your family unit tends to be 10 to 15 people living in a large family group and not 3 to 5, you know, it's
right.
different.
Right. And there was a move to change social distancing to physical distancing just because of the nuance of not separating people socially, you know, spiritually, socially. That's a great example of how you can't really legislate language, or you can't really dictate how people are going to use language, because social distancing really took hold in a way that physical distancing never did.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett. They host and produce Away with Words. We're talking about how in just a few short months, COVID-19 has pushed us to add words and phrases to the English language, to our conversations. And we want to hear from you. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What COVID-related words have become part of your conversations every day? Does using them make you feel like part of a community of sorts, or do you bristle at language being manipulated by current events? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about how COVID-19 has changed the English language and how that process happens. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett are with us. They are co-hosts and co-producers of the public radio program Away with Words. And there's room for you in our conversation. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Is there a COVID term that you find fun and clever? Or maybe there's one that gets on your nerves. Maybe there's one you think we should be using but hasn't caught on. This is your chance to give it a boost. Call 800-642-1234. We've got Emily in Montfort on the line. Hi, Emily.
Hello. The word that I hear a lot now is scam-demic, because of all of the scamming for the personal protective equipment and even now the potential for a vaccine. We've just been hearing a lot of scam-demic.
And are you, Emily, are you hearing that like in conversations with family or friends you're talking to, or do you hear it in a professional setting?
More so with friends and coworkers.
Yeah. All right, Emily, thanks for bringing up scam-demic for us. So we've got another play on the word pandemic, Martha.
We do indeed. And I think that the first syllable of pandemic is so handy for rhyming. I mean, there's that conspiracy theory film floating around Plandemic, which is the same kind of play on words. And scamdemic is yet another example. Grant, I'm not aware of other rhyming.
Shamdemic is another one.
Shamdemic.
And all three of those words, scamdemic, plandemic, and shamdemic, have been hashtags, usually by the COVID deniers, the people who think it's not really a big deal and no worse than the common cold. For what that's worth.
Yeah, and I think that brings up the idea that sometimes language changes because we need it for different reasons. And sometimes we catch on to something that is kind of moving through and we use it for our own devices.
Yeah. Yeah. So she, the caller had one meaning of it, the scamdemic, and the COVID deniers have another meaning for scamdemic. Yeah. But there are so many different scams out there. It's incredible the flood of emails and spam that you can get, just a ton of different angles that they're taking on this. But yeah, tons of fake masks for sure.
That kind of brings us to other different words that we've been using when it comes to the health part of the pandemic. You know, we talked about social distancing, but there are also things, phrases like flatten the curve or contact tracing, even PPE, which before, I mean, it took me a while to catch on and really use PPE. And now I refer to personal protective equipment by PPE without another thought. Martha, how about this? What is it about this process of like hearing new words and phrases that we somehow internalize and then use like it's no big deal?
Right. Well, again, if it's useful, you know, I mean, how else are you going to refer to PPE? It's a really useful term. And you find that in medical situations where a medical team is working together. You know, some people will hear a medical team using all this slang and jargon and, you know, maybe roll their eyes. But for a medical group, it's really, really useful. We actually had a call on the show early in the pandemic about a nurse who was talking about how do you decohort a group of patients. You know, you put all the patients who have COVID in one area of a hospital, and then when they get better and you're distributing them around the hospital, how do you take them out of that cohort? And they were trying to figure out a short, efficient way to say, take them out of the cohort. And I think they settled on decohorting. It's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard to say, and it's a kind of awkward jargon. But Martha, you really nailed it. It's not just that it's useful. It surprises people, Keely, that a word doesn't need to be clever. It doesn't need to be funny or even memorable to succeed. It really, the main thing, it has to be useful. That's it. Actually, funny words tend not to last very long. They tend to burn out like a firecracker real fast.
Yeah, I mean, I do like terms like Zoom mullet, which is, a hairstyle that was developed in lockdown so that you're camera ready, but maybe it doesn't look so good in the back, or Zoom mullet applying to the clothing that you wear from the top up because that's all you need for a Zoom meeting. That's also called upperwear, which is another one of those clever rhyming things. You know, it's upperwear rather than Tupperware, I guess.
I feel a little too seen in this part of the conversation across the radio.
Good thing it's radio, right? That's what we say.
Very good thing that it's radio. We have a little bit more humor here with Lynn from Hostisford. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. It's Hostisford, but that's okay.
Thank you.
The word that I have come up seeing around, being used around, is COVIDiot. Which means someone who refuses to or just doesn't go along with the rules about mask wearing and physical distancing and that kind of a thing. And they are a COVIDiot.
Lynn, thank you for bringing up COVIDiot as we talk about ways that people are trying to make light of some really challenging circumstances. Granted, it plays into so much of what we've already talked about here.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the most popular pandemic coinages. It was repeatedly recoined. And as a matter of fact, it was coined in Spanish and other languages as well. COVIDiota. Because languages have the word idiot or idiota in a variety of forms. It works perfectly there, too.
So it's challenging for us to translate social distancing into other languages, but COVIDiot we can manage.
COVIDiot's easy, yeah. COVIDiot is also known as a Morona sometimes,
okay.
And they are responsible for spreading the Morona virus. It's got a lot of different uses, and sometimes it's flipped. It's not just the people. Sometimes it's not the people who refuse to obey the rules about not spreading the virus. Sometimes it's the COVID deniers using the term to refer to mask wearers and people who do follow the rules. So the term is flipped. So it's generally the person on the other side of your opinion about how or whether or not to follow the rules about the pandemic and lockdown and quarantine and so forth.
Wow. Brings us to this idea that regardless of whether the word is old or new or something we've cobbled together or resurrected, Martha, context is everything.
context is indeed everything, as Grant just demonstrated.
Yeah. I want to address the concept of corona babies. Who wants to take that one on?
Well, as the father of a 13-year-old, I guess I'm more qualified than Martha. She's got stepchildren.
Hey, you take it on. What are corona babies, Grant?
Well, corona babies, by the year, I guess it's 2033, they will be quarantines. Right? Did I do the math correctly there, Martha?
Yeah, that's close enough. Yeah, quarantines, E-E-N-S. Quarantines.
Yeah, the quarantines. So the corona babies are due any day now, assuming that people got to work right away as soon as the pandemic hit and they had all this extra time. Because remember, if you remember, at the start of the pandemic, when people started going into lockdown, people started working at home, some people just strictly had time off. A lot of schools were closed. The kids weren't even studying at home. The schools were just closed. They spent a lot of time gaming or with their headphones on. People had a lot of free time. So people did what they do with their free time. Besides baking, they did found other fun things to do at home.
Yeah, I mean, so. We have blizzards here in the Midwest. We understand how this works.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes they're called coronials.
Okay. Coronials.
Yeah, so the coronials. Corona babies, so these, supposedly there will be a baby surge starting just about now.
We will pay attention to that.
And those of us who didn't get to work making babies, we still put on the COVID-19, some of us. You know?
Oh, yes.
If we weren't exercising sufficiently or we were watching and being inspired by too many episodes of the Great British Baking Show, we put on the Corona-19, which is also known as fattening the curve.
Let's talk about that just ahead. I want to mention that Karen and Appleton called and mentioned the term pandemic puppy to refer to the dogs that have been adopted during pandemic because people were feeling lonely and ready to care for someone. So that's somewhat connected to corona babies. This conversation is not over. We've got Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from the public radio program Away with Words talking about the words and phrases that are part of our everyday speech thanks to the coronavirus. And there's still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed language changing right now? What have you picked up on? Give us a call. We'll talk more about it. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Think back a year ago, and these words and phrases probably wouldn't have meant much. Social distancing, WFH, Zoom bombing, quarantini. Things are different now. We're talking about the words that we use and how that's changed in a pandemic, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What have you noticed about the things that you're saying now or the words you're hearing from other people? Do you like watching how language changes, or do you wish it would just slow down a little bit? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett are with us. They are co-hosts and co-producers of the public radio program Away with Words. And Martha, we were just talking about briefly, you know, a play on words for gaining a lot of weight in quarantine. And I wonder how much that plays into quarant baking. This is another thing where people are taking part of a word and smashing it up against another one to try to explain something that is happening specifically during this pandemic.
Yes, we're having to find words for these experiences that maybe we've never had before. I mean, I've never done much baking myself, but I did a bunch over the weekend, believe it or not. But yes, this is sometimes called comfort baking. It's sometimes called therapeutic baking. I think that it's sort of similar to doing crossword puzzles. You know, it's something that you can control. It's something that has an outcome, and it's something that feels good when you finish. But yeah, we have all of these portmanteaus, smashed up words like that, like quarantini. As long as you're in the kitchen, you know, you might be mixing yourself a quarantini.
And what is it, though, that prompts us to say quarantini as opposed to martini, as opposed to saying quarant baking instead of just admitting that we're baking? Is it because of the circumstances that word baking just doesn't seem to tell us enough?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. Plus, we humans love playing with language. We're such an inventive species when it comes to this kind of thing. And yeah, as we were saying earlier, people are going to be throwing that kind of linguistic jelly against the wall, and some of it'll stick, and a whole lot of it won't.
Yeah, Grant. What about words that that we wind up using that are actually letters? when we say WFH, it's hard to say, but we see it a lot, I think, in writing when it comes to work from home. How do those evolve? Is that differently or the same as, I don't want to say real words, but I mean words that are not acronyms?
Yeah, initialisms, I think, is what you're looking for there. Yeah, initialisms do evolve the same way. They're very clearly a shorthand, right? They look, they take up a lot less space. WFH is more common in writing than spoken. I bet you won't hear it spoken. This one dates to the 1990s, at least, when laptops became more dominant in the business world and you could actually have people more easily working from home. So work from home became a thing. And now I hear WFH almost as often as I hear, well, anyone want to go back to the office? at least in, you know, all these think pieces and a variety of different articles on Medium and different newspapers and blogs and so forth. But yeah, they behave the same way. Those initialisms tend not to last, though. We're kind of resistant to them unless they can be pronounced because they're missing. They're like a table missing a few legs. You know, they really need to be spoken as well as written in order to thoroughly succeed.
So WFH is hard to say, but something like LOL, I hear people say that still.
Yeah,
I remember when that first came about.
Yeah, because people can say lol, or they can say I did it for the lols, right?
Yeah, or BT dubs.
All
for
of that.
By the way.
Yeah. Interesting, for sure. What about this idea of maskne? It's a combination of mask and acne. Is that something you've noticed taking any ground there?
The makeup blogs are all over this. The Instagrammers who are all about, you know, makeup and tips on looking good, they are making a mint off of this. There are already products out there designed to fix your maskne. They're making a mint. They're selling it. It's hashtag crazy on Instagram and other places for this. So yeah, it's a thing, or at least the marketers think it's a thing. It follows the tradition of bacne, which is back acne, which I know sounds gross, but it's actually a word.
It sounds like then we're seeing different words emerge in different places. Pandemic yeah. seems to be kind of a collective, but some of the others are more niche.
Yeah, but you know, maskne, although the marketers and Instagrammers and, you know, the beauty bloggers are using it, you will also see it amongst the medical professionals who are wearing masks, you know, 1, 2, 3 shifts a day, you know, 18 hours at a stretch. And it's a real thing that they're concerned about. And they pass tips back and forth to each other where they're like, oh, you know, I put this on my face before I put on the mask, or this other mask. I don't have the same problem with the mask because they're as concerned as the rest of us about looking nice for ourselves and for our loved ones. So yeah, it's different worlds, but yeah, I don't think anyone in Congress is passing legislation about maskne, whereas they are definitely talking about pandemic.
Yeah, so again, it has to do with what's useful. Which of these clever coinages are going to be useful? I mean, I confess that during much of the past year, I was guilty of doom scrolling, scrolling through Twitter and dreading more impending doom. And I think doom scrolling may stick around as a clever coinage. I'm not so sure about glee freshing. This is instead of doom scrolling, you refresh your your Twitter feed looking for or experiencing great news. But I think doom scrolling is here to stay. What do you think, Grant?
Yeah, I found examples of it on Twitter back to 2018, but it was never really that common until obviously it spiked in 2020. I've seen doom surfing used as well, but I think it will last because it's so plugged into what the social media companies have done, which is they've made these addictive products that give us little spikes of chemicals in our brain when we get what we're after. You know, we scroll and there's the thing we wanted. And these little spikes of chemicals give us that little jolt that we wanted, whether it was a negative jolt or a positive jolt, or we are rewarded. And I think there's the circuit is completed there. And the doom scrolling is kind of we are rats in a cage pressing the lever and the food pellet drops, basically.
That is a really optimistic view here. Thank you for that.
I'm sorry.
You're just telling it like it is. I hear you. We've got one more caller who's on the line ready to talk with us. Hey, Kimberly from Fox Lake.
Hi. So I used a comment on a couple of words that they were words before, but I've been using them obviously a lot more lately. One like on site. People are on site or working from home or sourdough starter. But one word that became a word I remember at the end of last year, but right in time for quarantine, was binge watching. And I've definitely heard that thrown around a lot since March.
Yeah, Kimberly, thanks for bringing that up, because binge watching has been around longer. And yet, again, with so much time trying to, you know, stay distance from other people and staying at home, people are binge watching more.
Yeah, I think we have a different sense of time. Like we were talking about before, talking about Blur's Day or What Does It Matter Day. We have a different sense of time. And I think that binge watching is symptomatic of that, even though, as you said, it's been around it predates the pandemic by several years.
Maybe 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Because that really came with the ability to have on-demand screenings of anything and just keep going one after another after another.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It came kind of with DVD releases of your favorite shows. You could just pop in disc after disc. Yeah.
Yeah. Back in the before times. That's a term I'm hearing. You know, that's a term I'm hearing more and more. And I really like it. It almost sounds like, you know, something from a dystopian novel or something. You know, I remember in the before times.
Capital T.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very curious to know what we're going to call that and to bring the conversation back to a more optimistic point of view. You know, what we're going to call the after times.
Yeah. Well, I have no answers for any of that, but it has been lovely to talk to you in the now times, and hopefully we'll talk to you in the future times. Martha, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you, Keely.
And Grant, we appreciate you too.
Keely, it's been a pleasure.
Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett co-host and produce the public radio program Away With Words. And we've been talking about how COVID-19 has changed the English language. You can hear Away With Words on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9 o'clock. Coming up, we look at the history of the grocery store. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. For the better part of the year, COVID-19 has changed a grocery shopping run from a typical, if boring, chore to an excursion. While some popular items may be out of stock at your local grocery store, for the most part, there's still a lot to buy when you're there. That's largely by design, as the supermarket is all about conveying abundance. Central Time host Rob Ferret spoke with The Atlantic's Bianca Bosker this summer about her piece looking at how the COVID-19 era is just the latest chapter in a long and changing history of the supermarket. Here's their conversation.
Well, you start your piece off on grocery stores looking back at your childhood memories of growing up. Why does that strike a nostalgic chord with you?
Well, I think that I always felt this way, but I think a lot of people have also sparked sort of a reappreciation for the supermarket in the midst of everything that's been going on. And, you know, I would argue that supermarkets may be routine, but they are anything but ordinary. They are amazing, unlikely places that just sort of boggle the imagination when you get right down to it.
And in the span of human history, they're pretty new, and they were, you write, a really revolutionary innovation. Can you talk about sort of the before and after of the supermarket?
Yeah, totally revolutionary. So first, let's define what a supermarket is. So technically speaking, a supermarket is a place that houses between 15,000 to 60,000 different items that satisfy our desire to buy everything from tampons to sliced turkey within a single, you know, under a single roof. They're huge. They've about quadrupled in size in the last 90 years. The first one in America, I should say that, you know, they really are a pretty distinctly American phenomenon. The first one in the U.S. was actually emerged in 1930 in Jamaica, Queens, in New York. And they were just marvels. You have to keep in mind that for about 300 years before that, we would get things to eat, you know, in sort of outdoor markets, places that, you know, people would bring, you know, the meat to be butchered, produce. But these were places that had mud, there was flies, there was haggling, bargaining. And supermarkets really took the Fordist factory with its emphasis on efficiency and standardization and turned it into a place to shop for food. And they were actually so revolutionary that when Queen Elizabeth came on her first, I believe, official state visit to the United States, she specifically requested a tour of a Maryland giant food. Likewise, Boris Yeltsin, he also had a very official state visit to Texas and took an unscheduled detour to a Texas supermarket that is credited with souring him on communism, that he just saw this bounty of choice, this overwhelming, you know, encyclopedic choice that you find at the typical supermarket. So I think that's interesting to keep in mind when we perhaps grumble about having to, you know, roll our carts down the aisles.
And you write some about what a logistical feat it is to get stuff into stores, especially when it comes to produce. You spend some time with a trucker who, you know, will go from Washington to Florida or whatever with produce. Produce is a really fussy thing to carry in a truck, it turns out.
Yeah, so she, I wrote about the sort of different individuals that make up the supply chain. And supply chain is, I think, sometimes sounds like a boring word for what is a really miraculous operation, even more so in the midst of a pandemic. But yeah, so I spent some time speaking with a trucker who hauls reefer, and basically reefer, you know, is a refrigerated truck. And she spends a lot of time hauling produce, which is considered sort of one of the most finicky things that a trucker can move around the country, because it turns out that produce is very temperamental, right? It goes bad. It can get too cold. It can get too hot. Apples are very gassy, as it turns out, which can make a lot of other produce that it might travel with turn brown. So it really is, it's a feat. And it's one that was, you know, also difficult and concerning, especially because at the time when I was writing this piece in April, she found it really difficult to not only find masks and you know, Lysol, but even to find food. I mean, it was an incredible and depressing irony that here she was bringing, in this case, apples from Wenatchee, Washington to Florida. And, you know, she couldn't find sliced bread to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
We are talking about the history of the supermarket, how it's changed over the years, how it's changing today. Bianca Bosker is with us from The Atlantic. She wrote a piece, "The Pandemic Shows Us the Genius of Supermarkets." There have been changes in the current era, you write, not just because of COVID. There's a change in ownership with these investment groups buying grocery stores, and it doesn't turn out so great sometimes for the supermarkets and their customers.
Yeah, so I did kind of focus my story on a supermarket chain. I mean, sort of small, but it was growing, called Fairway, that was a real New York City institution. It's where my home is. And, you know, it did see this change of ownership and infusion of private equity money that we've seen really changing the landscape for many supermarkets around the country, and unfortunately not always for the better. I think the other thing that's interesting is the way that the supermarket is both, again, sort of seems like, well, I guess it seems a bit, you know, humble. It's where we get our staples, but the amount of research and kind of scientific papers that have looked at how we behave in supermarkets in order to try and tweak our behavior and get us to buy more is just fascinating. I mean, the science of supermarkets kind of blew my mind. I don't think I'll ever shop for groceries the same way again.
Well, what kind of things are they trying to figure out about how to get us to buy stuff?
Well, so first of all, like, what do they know? Well, what they found out through a combination of things like surveys and eye tracking and cameras is that we spend, well, a lot of our time in, quote, and this is an official scientific term, ineffective wandering at the supermarket. So the average supermarket visit is about 13 minutes in length, and only about 30% of that time do we actually spend buying something. And when we do buy something, that process actually does happen pretty quickly. Apparently, it's on average 13 seconds, and that includes, you know, wandering down the aisle, finding the thing that you're looking for, and plucking it off the shelf. I mean, I feel like I spend that much time, you know, just staring slack-jawed at mustard alone. I mean, it's just, I don't know. But, you know, what I think that information is then used to determine planograms. So the layout of a supermarket is very carefully engineered down to the square inch. First, when you look at the whole level of the store, most supermarkets tend to be organized sort of what I would describe as like a reverse mullet. So you've got party in the front and business in the back. So you walk in and there's this abundant bounty of colorful produce. Whereas the staples, the things like your bread and milk, tends to be tucked further in the back. And there are various explanations for that, but one of them is really that by putting the things that we need to have further back, it does force us to walk through the whole store and hopefully pick up some things along the way. When you get down to the level of the shelf, again, you've got these planograms that take that information about, you know, studies that find that we think more highly of products placed on higher shelves and sort of meets out what products will go where based on that. So, for example, some grocers put their higher margin items at eye level because those move more quickly. We tend to buy more of them. On the other hand, data is one way to choose where things go, but cash is another. And many supermarkets do employ slotting fees, which basically means that, you know, you are seeing those cookies on that particular golden spot on the shelf because someone paid very handsomely to put them there.
I want to end on what might lead to a public service announcement here. You talk to also a retail worker, somebody who works at the checkout at a grocery store, and I've done this at a much smaller grocery store. Most people are nice. Some people are mean. And during COVID, this is a tough job. Can you talk about the experience that that she had at some of the tougher times?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it seems like very difficult work, right? I mean, you're on your feet, you can get sore backs. And, you know, there's so many difficult parts of the job, but it was really disheartening to hear to what extent we, the customers, the people, were the disheartening part of the job, you know, really, you know, giving people a hard time, being rude, being gruff. And I was really inspired by this person who worked at a Fairway in New York City, who really, you know, actually just turned it into an opportunity to try and kind of turn people's days around, to kind of crack jokes, lighten their mood after waiting in these long lines. But, you know, it's incredibly difficult work. And again, people at all parts of the supply chain, the truckers, the cashiers, the people working, at the Hunts Point Market, for example, just really impressive. Again, amazing and extraordinary, even though it can feel very ordinary. And some might even say boring to go to the supermarket. I hope to change that perspective.
Bianca, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Bianca Bosker of The Atlantic. She spoke with Central Time host Rob Ferret this summer about the changing role of supermarkets, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can find a link to her article over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up this week on Central Time, people donate to political candidates they agree with and people they want to win. But are you putting your money in the right place or is it a waste? We've got that conversation on the show tomorrow. And later in the week, we look into what's happening with Wisconsin's partial vote recount. We'll get the latest on the certification of votes and what happens next as lawsuits loom. Those stories and more are coming up this week on Central Time. Sometimes people do inexplicable things, and this is one of those times. A team of moms voluntarily walked barefoot on Legos for 1 hour.
The Guinness Book of World Records virtually confirmed that last month that the relay team walked 328 laps on a Lego course to capture the record. In case you'd forgotten what hundreds of tiny plastic blocks sound like, here's a reminder.
Give me that, please.
Yeah, that's the sound at my place. Usually the kids are fighting over one single block in the entire bin of teeny single blocks. Anyway, back to the barefoot walk. It took five women, 8 months of planning, two medical professionals to verify their feet, three independent witnesses, 19 kids to throw Legos that escaped during the walk back onto the track, and more than 200 pounds of Lego blocks. The parent who started this operates on a family motto that we were made to do hard things. And as a person who regularly steps on Legos and who regularly shrieks in pain, it's hard for me to fully understand the motivation here. Yes, parents, people can do hard things, but should we? We all make our own choices, and I certainly don't have a world record to show for it, but at my place, I think I'll keep my tennis shoes on. Thanks. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.